This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's turn our attention to the world of politics. Quebec Premier François Legault says adult residents who refuse to get vaccinated against COVID-19 for non-medical reasons will be charged a financial penalty.
The vaccine is the key to fight the virus. This is why we're looking for a health contribution for adults who refuse to be vaccinated for non-medical reasons. Those who refuse to receive their first dose in the coming weeks will have to pay a new health contribution.
Legault points to the fact that while only 10% of eligible Quebecers are not vaccinated, they make up nearly 50% of ICU cases.
It's a question also of fairness for the 90% of the population who made some sacrifices. I think we owe them this kind of measure.
Let's bring in veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver for his perspective on this. Hey, good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Craig, there is a federal angle to this, and we'll get there in a moment. But for now, what are your general thoughts on this strategy being put forward in Quebec?
No vax, pay the tax. Dave, this is really a nuclear option. It's a nuclear option. People are just starting to understand now how significant and important this is. The federal government and the provinces have done everything they can to pressure non-vax, anti-vaxxers into taking the shot. They've come up with all kinds of ideas at fewer and fewer places they can get into without the passports in most of the country. This was a last resort. And remember that in a sense, you'll notice that the premier keeps talking about a contribution to healthcare, but basically it is a tax as part of the healthcare system, which isn't how that works. Remember, healthcare in Canada is free, isn't it? That's what I always thought.
Mm-hmm. Right.
so he's gone ahead with this, and the whole country, all of the premiers and the federal government, we'll be watching very closely to see how well this goes down with Quebecers. The premier has already got very serious political problems. His support has been dropping significantly recently, as much as 14% in the last poll. And his curfew is immensely unpopular. So I think there's going to be big trouble with Quebecers over this tax.
So right, let's delve a little deeper into that, Craig, because you know vaccine mandates can be something of a political hot button. What is or is there a political risk here for Premier Legault?
That's the point I'm making, is that there absolutely is a political risk for him at a time when he has an election of his own coming up, I think next summer at some point. And so he has to worry about that. He has to worry about it a lot, and he's already, seen the result of the anger Quebecers, especially certain kind of Quebecers, and especially Quebecers who don't want to see any interference with what they regard as their right not to take a needle and take the shot if they don't want to take it.
Yeah.
And so he's now saying, okay, if that's going to be your attitude, then we're going to start charging you for medical services, because that's what it amounts to.
Staying in Quebec for one more question, Craig, then I promise we'll get to the federal side of this. Whether it be the curfews, needing a vaccine certificate to get into alcohol or cannabis stores, or now the idea of a tax for the unvaccinated, does it feel like Quebec is the province that's willing to throw the most ideas at the wall in terms of pandemic policy, at the very least within the borders of Canada?
Yes, it has been. Quebec has been since the very beginning. They've come up with ideas to try to resolve these issues in ways other provinces have talked about but never done. And so that's why, as I say, they're going to be watching very closely, especially on this one, But as they have on others too, it was Quebec who had first started shutting down theaters and bars and restaurants and places where they sell pot and alcohol. All of that, the other provinces are going to have to be considering if they're going to rescue the healthcare system, which is being badly hurt by the non-vaxxers.
So let's broaden this out to the federal picture. In a press conference last Friday, Health Minister Jean-Yves Duclos says he thinks that mandatory COVID vaccination is going to be necessary.
What we see now is that our healthcare system in Canada is fragile. Our people are tired. And the only way that we know to go through COVID-19, this variant and any future variant, is through vaccination.
Duclos suggested that dealing with COVID is going to require a more national approach with provincial cooperation.
They see what's coming. So they know that public health measures that everyone understands now will need to be applied across Canada because it's the same variant across Canada. So although a province may be just a week or two behind another province in terms of a stress on healthcare resources, that's coming, and sometimes coming very quickly.
And I've got one more clip for you here. Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs Dominique Leblanc offered further insight on where the federal government stands on vaccine requirements and then took a political snipe at Conservative leader Erin O'Toole.
Vaccines work, and vaccines are the best way out of this pandemic. That's why we put in place mandatory vaccine requirements for federally regulated workplaces and for people wanting to travel by airplane or train. But Mr. O'Toole won't support these requirements.
Just getting that little snipe in for Erin O'Toole at the end. But Craig, what's your reaction to the assertion that public restrictions may require a more national approach moving forward? And Minister Duclos' suggestion that provinces will have to come up with their own stricter vaccine mandates?
Well, they'll have to decide that. That's a decision for provinces. But the Prime Minister has exploited this to the farthest extent politically. And I must say, the Conservative leader has walked right into the Prime Minister's trap. The Prime Minister, as you know, referred to the anti-vaxxers as racists, misogynistic people, very tough language. He basically demonizing them. I'm not sure that's a wise way to go if you are a prime minister and you want to have a united country, but that's what he's doing. And he wants most Canadians to believe what many increasingly do, that the NDP is supporting this. They are supporting the anti-vax movement. In fact, they have to be seen to be doing that. And politically, that's a disaster for the Conservative leader. Does he really need that 8 or 10% of his party who are anti-vaxxers? Does he really need them that badly, he thinks, in order to win an election? I'm very puzzled by the way he's been acting on this and by the things he's been saying. They're playing right into the Prime Minister's trap set for the Conservative leader and his party.
Craig, as we break down the numbers from the last election, we saw the People's Party of Canada didn't necessarily swing enough seats to have won the Conservatives the election.
Say the least.
But there were a number of votes out there that existed for the People's Party of Canada. Do you think it's a wise strategy for the Conservative leader to be trying to court those votes on sort of the People's Party side that they feel they bled out to Maxime Bernier versus trying to take a little bit more of a nuanced position on the vaccine?
He doesn't need support and help from extremists. No, what he needs is moderates, and he's losing them in huge numbers, especially as he is seen to be the defender of the anti-vax movement. He would deny that he is that, but nevertheless, he's saying some accommodation has to be found. He said in his first speech of the new year. And you can bet that the Liberals in the Prime Minister's office sure heard that, and they spread the word.
Craig, I've got a bit of an off, switching gears here, but still staying in the COVID conversation, kind of making you more the campaign advisor than necessarily a political correspondent. But in the midst of hearing a lot of public health messaging in response to the most recent wave, and really during all the waves of the pandemic, we hear about our hospital systems at risk of being overwhelmed or on the brink of collapse. Now, this would be really hard for an incumbent to do. But Craig, if I made you a political advisor for an opposition party in an upcoming election, like in Ontario, for example, how much traction would a party get from building a platform around, quote, fixing the healthcare system?
Well, Dave, that really depends on how you intend to fix it. For instance, if you're the Premier of Ontario, a hardcore conservative, you think the way to fix it is to have a lot more free enterprise, a lot more outside parties sharing in the wealth, sharing in the tax payments, getting them involved, free enterprise business, rather than have it all done by government. You can hear them saying, oh, that's a waste. Government is less efficient than businesses, and we should allow these businesses to take some of the things that where they're very crowded in terms of national health care, and let them do it. This is war with the left in Canada, and it's against everything which is permitted at the moment by the Canada Health Act. That would have to be changed by whatever political party decides. So this is a very dicey business. Yeah, there are some gains to be seen to defending the healthcare system, but the question is, what policy are you going to use to defend it?
Yeah, the platform needs to go well beyond just the quotes of we're going to fix the healthcare system. People want to know how you're going to do that. Hey, Craig, one last question here on the COVID front. How much is a general fatigue in combination with maybe general boredom impacted the way people are perceiving the politics and public health messaging around the pandemic at this moment?
I think it's immense. I think there's an immense tired groan from across the country. Well, not only that, I shouldn't play it as if it's light. It has caused breakup of families. It has caused emotional distress, mental illness. It has been a very, very stressful 2 years for Canadians, and they're tired of it. They're worn out. They're completely stressed, and they want to get back to having lives again. And we all do, and so do people in government. And one hopes that there's some tiny little signals that, for instance, that the British 6 days in a row have seen a significant drop in their cases. And so have, by the way, all five boroughs in New York City, really quite significant drop in cases. So maybe something is starting to happen out there with the latest on Omicron, but one can only hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. Take a little bit of that hope where we can, certainly in these times. Hey, Craig, let's jump into a big international story. I know it's one that you've been following closely and I've been following as well. Tensions persist between the United States and Russia. Over 100,000 Russian troops remain stationed at the border with the Ukraine. High-level diplomatic meetings this week have not caused either side to budge. There's a big meeting between the NATO nations and Russia today. The United States wants those troops to fall back. The Russians want further assurances that NATO will not expand its presence in the region. Craig, this feels a bit like a Cold War scenario here.
It is that, and it is very dangerous. What were, you know, the initial demands, which are still standing, still on the table from Mr. Putin, actually amounted to asking the NATO to surrender. It was a surrender document. Yeah. Sign this. The demands they have put on NATO, the United States and NATO, are far beyond anything that any respectable American president or leader could ever agree to. They sacrifice so much of what NATO represents. And I think that simply can't happen. So maybe it'll come back to the Russians finally, and they're going to have to make the tough decision about whether to invade. If they do invade, and, you know, they want the Ukraine back. Putin wants Ukraine back. Remember that the history matters. For 300 years, Ukraine was a diamond in the crown of the Russian Federation. And it was a huge humiliation for them when the Soviet Union broke up to lose Ukraine. And he has already bitten off two large chunks of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So he's already owns quite a bit of it. And now he wants the whole thing. And he's going to get it if he has to invade or not. If he invades, he will at least, of course he'll win. His army is a lot larger than that of Ukrainians, but he'll get a bloody nose. Mm-hmm. The Allies won't put troops in there, but they will certainly help them with a lot of good equipment, especially ground-to-air rocketing and that kind of thing, and anti-tank weapons.
Craig, we know optics matter to the Russian President Vladimir Putin, whether it be scoring 9 goals in exhibition hockey games or riding shirtless on a horse showing off his beautiful physique. But what are the consequences domestically if Putin ends up backing down and withdrawing his forces from these borders?
Well, he would be seen in the eyes of Russians. And, you know, it has increasingly been a complete dictatorship, not that it matters that much. Anybody who's ever tried to replace Putin, anybody who becomes popular, also becomes dead fairly quickly. This has been the history of the last while. So he would be seen as a weakened leader, and he can't afford that. So my guess is he probably wants to invade, and he wants to be able to say, I gave, you know, a real chance. I made an offer, a number of offers to NATO, and they rejected everything. So I had no choice but to not allow a country like Ukraine to be on our border and be a NATO country. Mm. We don't want to be surrounded by NATO everywhere.
Craig, we're a little tight for time here, so I've got to kind of hold you to a minute on this answer. But just as okay. We're wrapping up, you came across some data, polling data about political polarization and the difference in Canada and the U.S. So this is something that I think we're going to be revisiting in politics throughout this year. But what did you find so interesting about this data?
In the last 7 years, since the surveys like these were taken in the States and in Canada, significant numbers of Americans have moved from identifying themselves as centrists who believe in the system. They have moved to the right in a big way. In Canada, it's been the very opposite. Canadians, by 5 points, 5% more than 7 years ago, say they respect the system, they believe in it, they believe that they are centrists and moderates. In the U.S., they went the other way and said, well, they've moved toward extremism, toward Trumpism, mm-hmm. in big numbers. Mm-hmm. That tells you a lot, I think, about where the future of the relationship between Canada and the States is going to be, and particularly about the chances of Biden hanging on to the presidency.
Yeah, it's a midterm election year this year in the United States, so we'll be following that one south of the border. Craig, it's always lovely getting to chat with you. Thank you for making so much time for us today, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Anytime, Dave. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.